First, new research shows that MDMA, also known as ecstasy or Molly, has a lot of potential to help heal severe cases of things like post-traumatic stress disorder. MDMA has been a popular party drug and a Schedule I controlled substance, the most restrictive level of drug control in the U.S. It has a history full of twists and turns, stretching back to 1912 and featuring use by therapists, ravers, and government agents trying to discover a truth serum during the Cold War. As with some other psychedelic drugs, scientists are discovering that MDMA has the potential to help address not just PTSD, but depression, addiction, existential anxiety faced by terminal patients, and more. In a new book, our next guest traces the past, present, and future of MDMA as a therapy and in recreational use. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you used MDMA, and are you willing to share that story? What was your experience like with it? What do you want to know about how the drug works, its safety, or its potential to help PTSD and other mental health problems? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Rachel Neuer is a journalist and author. Her new book is I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. Rachel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
A lot of fascinating stories in your book. What led you, Rachel, to dig into this history of MDMA?
Oh, man, I just felt like the time was really ripe for MDMA to get its own story. You know, Michael Pollan really covered LSD and psilocybin in his book, How to Change Your Mind, a few years ago. But MDMA is a molecule with just as rich a history and a story in terms of politics, culture, science, and mental health.
Take us back to the invention of this drug in 1912, I think you write. And then it seems like people didn't really know what to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, the story really begins on Christmas Eve 1912, when the German pharmaceutical company Merck filed a patent for MDMA, but they weren't actually looking for MDMA. It was just a chemical intermediary on a series of steps they were taking to get to a blood clotting agent. Merck denies that they ever realized that MDMA actually had psychoactive properties. That denial is a little questionable. But yeah, it popped up again in the 1950s during the U.S.'s search for a chemical truth serum, really unethical period in U.S. history when the CIA and the Army were doing tests on American citizens and Army soldiers. We don't actually know if MDMA was ever given to anybody. We haven't found that sort of smoking gun document to prove that the Army did give people MDMA. What we do know, though, is that it reemerged in 1975 in the Bay Area when a chemist resynthesized it and introduced it to the therapeutic community.
Before we dig more into the history, I want to talk a little bit about what the drug MDMA does. And a weird thing is, it depends. It seems like the experience might be very different if I'm sitting down for a therapy session with talk therapists and taking this versus I'm on a dance floor with 120 beats per minute electronic music going. Why is it so? What do we know about why it's so context dependent?
Yeah. Well, like most or all, in fact, psychedelic drugs, it's really about the set and the setting. So that refers to your mindset, what you're going into the experience, your mental baggage, your expectations, and the actual physical setting. So I have never done MDMA in a therapeutic context, but, you know, I've heard people who have say, you know, I don't know why they call this ecstasy. This is not an ecstatic experience. This is really difficult, hard, profound work. Whereas if you're just going in to have some light fun and dance all night with your friends, you're going to have a completely different experience. It is going to be euphoric. You're going to feel a deep sense of connection on the dance floor. You're probably going to have a really good time.
And your book shares a title with the great Donna Summer groundbreaking song, I Feel Love. And that is apparently a common, not a universal, but a common part of an experience using this drug.
Yeah, it sure is. I mean, without knowing the title of my book, quite a few of my interview subjects use that exact phrase that, oh, you know, I felt love on this drug, or I even felt love for myself or for others for the first time in my entire life, in the case of some highly traumatized people.
Talking to Rachel Neuer about her new book. It's called I Feel Love, MDMA, and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Rachel, you write that there was a period where we had people experimenting with MDMA as a therapy. Then it becomes outlawed effectively in 1985. Can you talk about that process that made it a Schedule I drug?
Yes. So therapists were introduced to MDMA quietly beginning in 1975, 1976, and it spread from the Bay Area out across the US and even to Europe. And they found that this was a really phenomenal tool that they could apply to pretty much any form of psychotherapy, whether it was couples therapy, helping people to process their trauma, or just helping people get more deeply in touch with themselves. But they knew that they needed to keep quiet about this new drug because they had seen what had happened to LSD a few years before. LSD in the 50s was given to some 40,000 patients around the world as a therapeutic aid, but then it was politicized, it was criminalized, it was outlawed. And they knew that if the US federal government caught wind of this new drug, the same fate would befall it. Well, lo and behold, that is what happened. The DEA caught wind of MDMA. They moved to schedule it, to put it on Schedule I, which is the most strictly banned substances with no current medical value, a high potential for abuse. The therapeutic community actually fought back against this. They put together a case, and they took the DEA to court. This was therapists, doctors, even Harvard professors arguing to the DEA that MDMA should in fact be a Schedule III drug, which would permit its use in medical context and also allow research to continue. They actually won that case. The administrative law judge sided with them and said, yes, MDMA should be Schedule III. But because it was an administrative case, the DEA only took that judgment as an opinion. And they just did, I guess, what they had planned to do all along, which was put MDMA on Schedule I, where it has remained ever since.
Things have loosened up some, you write. More people are able to do research. And I want to get into what seems to be the most advanced, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. What are therapists doing with MDMA for people with PTSD?
Yes. So this has been about a 20-year effort to test MDMA-assisted therapy's effectiveness for PTSD. It's just taken that long because of bureaucracy and also because researchers cannot easily get federal funding to test Schedule I substances. So that's why it's taken so long. But the results so far are really promising. The most recent phase 3 clinical trial, and this is 2 out of 3 necessary phase 3 trials before the drug can gain FDA approval. The results were very, very promising. About 2/3 of the 100 or so participants emerged after just 3 sessions of MDMA assisted therapy with no longer qualifying for a PTSD diagnosis. And these are people with severe cases of PTSD, with histories of suicidal ideation, with substance abuse disorders. They had PTSD for something like 16 years on average. So these are really, really promising results that sort of blow out of the water any results we've seen from just talk therapy alone or traditional pharmaceuticals.
A lot of your book deals with the stories of people who have used MDMA for treatment. Can you share a little bit about the people you met who had been through PTSD treatment involving MDMA?
Oh gosh, there were so many stories, and many of them were really emotional for me to hear. I heard from a veteran who had served in Vietnam and come back with really severe PTSD that he didn't recognize himself. And he lived with this crippling condition literally for decades until his wife was basically gave him an ultimatum and said, you have to get help for this or I can't stay with you. And after he did MDMA assisted therapy, he was finally able to recognize that deep, deep wound he had suffered as a result of what happened to him in Vietnam and begin to connect with himself, to forgive himself, and even to connect with his wife. He said that was the most beautiful thing that he got out of this. Now he's not afraid to talk to her and be honest with her about his feelings.
And I want to spell this out a little. This isn't, I get a prescription for an MDMA pill, I go home and I take it once a day or once a month or whatever. Can you talk through the process that people went through in this therapy?
Yeah, absolutely. That is such an important point. This isn't, here's your MDMA, go home and take it. And this also isn't, okay, well, we're going to meet here, you know, every week and take MDMA for the rest of your life. It's not a one and done process, but it's a lot closer to that model than something like traditional SSRIs or talk therapy would be. So you have a few sessions where you meet with a therapist, you talk about your issues, you talk about what you're hoping to get out of the actual medication session. Then on the day of, you meet with two therapists, ideally a man and a woman, and you put on blindfold, eye shades, you put on headphones, you take the pill, you lie back on a couch or a bed, and you wait for the drug to take effect. Some people, once it does take effect, get really chatty. You know, they want to talk to their therapist. They want to process things out loud. Some people go deep inside themselves and barely say a word the entire time. The whole thing takes about 7 or 8 hours. It's an entire day. For the clinical trials, at least, it was 3 sessions spaced a month apart. But in terms of the ideal number of sessions, that's something scientists and therapists are going to have to work out once this treatment is approved. You know, for some people, it could be fewer. For some people, it could be more.
We're talking to journalist and author Rachel Neuer about her new book. It's called I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you or a loved one have experienced PTSD, would you be willing to try this MDMA-assisted therapy? Have you sought it out yourself? Do you think MDMA should be legalized for medicinal use, for recreational use? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with journalist and author Rachel Neuer. Her new book is called I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for a Connection in a Fractured World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the latest research on the use of MDMA, that's often called ecstasy or Molly more recently, and other psychedelics to help with things like PTSD and other mental health conditions? Do you have experience with this particular drug yourself that you're willing to tell us about? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Rachel, I want to talk about why this particular drug might help in this particular way. And some of the research is looking at the idea of a critical period in our brains. Talk us through that.
Yeah, so researchers have wondered for years why it is that something that is so short-acting like MDMA can have such profound lasting effects. And new neuroscience coming out of the lab of Gul Dolin at Johns Hopkins seems to perhaps provide an answer to that question. So under the set and setting of therapy, so when you go in prime to interact with your trauma and with a therapist's guidance, the brain seems to reopen what neuroscientists call a critical period. Critical periods are finite periods of malleability, usually that occur in childhood, when the brain is primed to learn new things, to make new connections, to set us up with the habits that will give us a lifetime of success out here in the world. It's why, for example, children can learn a new language so much easier than we adults can. What MDMA seems to do under that therapeutic guidance is reopen a social reward learning critical period. And this allows people to really reevaluate and reassess their trauma, the stories they've told themselves about their trauma, about themselves, the habits they formed around that trauma. If you think about typical PTSD symptoms. So you're literally rewiring your brain when you do MDMA-assisted therapy, which is what makes it so powerful if these results are indeed accurate.
What is the frontier of research on this now, trying to connect the dots between using something like MDMA in a therapy session and making these changes?
Yeah, I mean, there's very interesting research on the horizon. There's already been studies on using MDMA for severe social anxiety in autistic adults. There are studies going on in the UK now for MDMA's use for treating alcohol addiction. What I think is really interesting is if these critical period results hold up, then MDMA and actually other psychedelic drugs could be so-called master keys for reopening critical periods. And what that means is if you tune the set and setting, if instead of doing talk therapy, for example, you do occupational therapy, you could reopen a different critical period for motor learning. So at Johns Hopkins, they're now pursuing the idea of giving stroke patients MDMA and then giving them occupational therapy to see if they can regain much, much greater mobility than they would without the drug.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Aaron is with us in Milwaukee. Aaron, hi.
Hi, how's it going today?
Good. What did you want to share with us?
Okay, so I was in the military from the periods of 2001 to 2008, and I did two tours of combat while I was in, and stress has really taken a toll just kind of like on my mental health. And I've tried different therapies as far as, you know, talk therapy, and I couldn't connect with the people enough to feel comfortable enough sharing everything that I've been through. I have just recently been exposed to microdosing with psilocybin, but I haven't started yet or tried it. But how can somebody that, like myself, whose profession really hinders their ability to seek all therapies, try something different that might work?
Aaron, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for sharing that. And I'm sorry you're dealing with this and haven't found a solution, at least not yet. But Rachel, Aaron's story sounds like a lot of the people you talked to in the book, and something he mentioned, he has a hard time being able to fully open up about his experiences in a talk therapy session. That's something you heard, I think, actually from veterans in your research.
Absolutely. Yeah, Aaron, thank you so much for sharing that story. And just know that you absolutely are not alone in these feelings. One of the beautiful things about MDMA-assisted therapy is the drug lowers activity in the amygdala, which is the brain's fear center. So people don't feel just our natural reaction to keep things to ourselves, to protect ourselves, to present a certain image of ourselves to the world. We're better able to just be ourselves and be open. MDMA also increases feelings of connection with other people, which really helps in terms of the therapeutic process and kind of speeding the process of building trust with your therapists. As far as accessing MDMA under the context of your current job, unfortunately, it is still currently illegal. So you're going to have to wait if you want to do it legally until the FDA approves it. But hopefully that will happen by this time next year. And I should add too that there are now trials going on at VAs around the country. I have not heard of any in Wisconsin, but you can look those up. There's one in the Bronx. There's one in Oregon, in Texas.
Aaron, thanks a lot for the call. We are talking to Rachel Neuer about her new book, I Feel Love, MDMA, and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World. Back to your calls now. Ruthann is with us in Madison. Ruthann, hi.
Hi. Yeah, my question, actually I have two of them, but I know that people experience PTSD for a variety of reasons, whether you're in the war, you could experience it from a bad car accident, also, you know, like from childhood traumas of every kind. So is there a type of PTSD that this works better for? I've not read your book, and maybe it's answered in there, but I'd like to read your book. I was also curious about how young or what's the ages that this can be used for other than adults, if so. So those are my questions.
Ruthann, thanks for the call. Rachel, you did talk to people who experienced different causes of PTSD. Your thoughts for Ruthann?
Yeah, both excellent questions. So the clinical trials involved not just veterans, but people with all forms of PTSD from childhood, from sexual assault, first responders, from natural disasters, things like that. And the results held up across the board. This seems to be an effective treatment regardless of the source of your PTSD. So that's great news. In terms of, what was the second part of that question?
How young are people being in trials for?
So these trials were for adults, but actually the FDA, if they approve MDMA-assisted therapy, there is a requirement that adolescents then have to go through clinical trials as well. So this could wind up being a treatment that can be given to adolescents as well, but we're going to have to await those safety and efficacy results.
Ruth Ann, thanks for the call. Rachel, I should ask, people might be listening thinking, hey, this is a Schedule One controlled substance. Aren't there risks? Are there harms? What do we know?
Yeah, definitely. MDMA, like anything, you know, like water, like aspirin, can be unsafe and even deadly if you take too much of it or you take it under the wrong circumstances. In a therapist's office, there have been no serious side effects or emergencies or anything like that. However, if you do take it out in the world illegally, you run the risk of taking tainted drugs because, again, you're having to buy the drug illegally. You don't know what you're getting unless you test it yourself. You also run the risk of accidentally taking too much MDMA and overdosing yourself if you're not testing the drugs for the percentage content and then weighing out an appropriate sample. The two things that tend to occur most often in terms of emergencies and even deaths from MDMA are overheating. So you're dancing all night, you're not drinking water, you're not taking breaks, and you perhaps took too much MDMA. And also some people wind up drinking too much water, and MDMA causes the body to retain water. So if you start chugging gallons of water, you can cause something called the name escapes me, but it lowers your sodium levels in your blood, which can cause your brain cells to swell, and that can be deadly. So hyponatremia, that is the name.
Rachel, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing your book with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Rachel Neuer, journalist and author. She talked to us about her new book. It's called I Feel Love, MDMA and the Quest for Connection in a Fractured World.